Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 8th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome Falstaff's little page boy, Beatrice Wells.
Sorry.
We didn't rehearse this well.
Should we trade?
No, we'll deal with it.
You're right.
Yes. Sit down.
Shall I sit down?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll sit down.
Was this the first time you saw the restoration?
Yes.
Really?
I mean, I only saw the trailer, and it's magnificent, isn't it?
And I have to say, I think everybody will agree with me. You are adorable in that picture.
I couldn't watch myself.
Can you do the Cockney accent for us?
No, I was dubbed.
I knew that, actually.
I was dubbed.
You actually, Keith Baxter, Prince Hal was here the other night, which is a wonderful night also.
Oh, yes.
And he told me you had an Italian accent in those days.
I don't know if this is true. I mean, maybe it's true.
Well, he was there. But you were too, I guess.
I was. I didn't know I did, maybe.
But you first did this part when you were four on stage?
Yes. I used to come out when I was 4 years old and when he did it in Dublin in 1960. And I was so excited because people put makeup on me and I was like, oh, you know. And I would toddle on and I would just wave at the end at the king. I was waving at the king and that was my
But did you understand the text?
No.
Oh. But you are the daughter
bright.
Of the boy genius.
I know. I am bright, but...
But you understand it now, yeah.
Of course. Of course.
But you were four, and you... Actually, your part was bigger originally.
Yes, yes.
And so what happened? Well, you say, oh, I have a small part. It's actually more than a big part.
Yes, it is. I actually was amazed. I got more and more embarrassed as the movie came along. I never wanted to do this.
You are actually a natural. And I don't want to say anything. Your sister, half-sister, Chris,
yes.
Played a page boy in
Macbeth.
Macbeth.
Right.
And she doesn't seem very comfortable with it. You seem like you're having a lot of fun.
Well, the movie was so much fun. I mean, I think Keith talked about this the other night. It was everybody had, at the beginning of the movie, you know, when everybody's so happy and jovial and all that stuff. I mean, that's really how the movie was. I mean, everybody, would stop and have lunch and naps. And and it was just so much fun to do. I mean, I was a little girl, and I loved it. I was very unhappy about having my hair all chopped off because I was, I was really nine I was actually eight when we started shooting, but I turned nine. And, you know, I was hanging around with this, we were living in Spain for half a second, and I was hanging around with Antonio Ordóñez's daughters who were gorgeous. You know, they had this beautiful long black hair. And there I was with this. And also a bad haircut, because he said I needed a bad haircut, because, of course, in those days, nobody had good haircuts. So I was very upset.
We didn't notice. You were wearing that adorable cap, too. I mean, do you still have that, by the way?
No, I wish. I wish I had something of Chimes. I don't.
Did your father want you to be an actor?
No.
Is that something you wanted?
No, never, never. I
You're
mean,
also...
Really, no, you have no idea. I mean, he asked me, he said, I want you to be in this movie. And I remember this sort of fear, terror coming over me and saying, oh, no, I don't want to do this. And then he promised me money.
Oh. Now, we know about your father.
And, of course, I never got paid.
Of course, yeah, that's right. I was hinting at that. Now... You say you have nothing left from Chimes, but in fact, I'm holding in my hand a precious object,
yes.
Which is your original script.
Yes.
With your name, yes. Beautifully handwritten, Beatrice Wells, by you. Did they have penmanship in Spain? Because that's gorgeous.
No, it took me probably so, 3 days to do that.
Beatrice
but
has...
I have to say something.
Yes, go ahead.
May I?
Yep, absolutely.
I had this, and I knew I was coming, and I really want to pass this around.
Now, are you sure you want to pass this around to 180 people?
There's a story behind this.
Okay.
It's not about the movie, but it's about, I said, how can I pass this around? It's falling apart. There's quite a few people here tonight, but I thought it would be nice for you to see it. And I asked a dear friend of mine if we could come up with an idea of how to cover this thing without ruining it. So it's actually Velcroed and plastic, and it took us 5 hours to do.
Well, let's see if it's still there at the end.
And I would really like to pass this around. And I want to say this is how much I was affected about having to play a boy. I noticed this today, actually, when we were doing the DVD. I wrote Beatrice Wells the first time, and then afterwards you can see there is Miss. Do you see that? Tiny. And you can see it, it's an afterthought, so I must have done it after.
Maybe your father put that in.
Oh, no, no, no. No, that's my handwriting.
It's got a period at the end.
Yes,
sure it doesn't
Miss.
Stand for Mississippi. No,
no,
Miss Beatrice Wells.
Miss. You see, I was thinking Mrs. You put a point afterwards.
Well, actors.
And I think, So.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I really do.
Luckily, we don't
like
serve
to.
Buttered popcorn. So
no, so it's got
starting
this
here, and
is,
be very careful.
If you want to see it, it's there.
So let's open up questions to the audience.
Can I say one thing
before?
I just want you to, I hope you understand how amazing this movie is, because he really had no money. I mean, that battle, you know, that battle was really made in the editing room. I mean, there was maybe, people have said 200. There was never 200 people. I was there when it was being shot. And it's an extraordinary piece of work. That battle is just unbelievable. I mean, it has affected people like Kenneth Branagh in Henry V. He said it publicly that he could never have made his battle scene. A Braveheart is another one. I mean, it's unbelievable. I need to say that for him.
And you were there for everything, for the filming and the editing.
Well, the editing, I was always there for editing, because wherever we were, there was always a room that had been rented, or if it was a hotel, it was a hotel room that had been rented. If we were living in an apartment, there was another apartment that had been rented where there was moviolas. Does anybody know what a moviola is? Good.
Our crowd knows. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. We lived with a moviola. So I probably was three the first time I ever sat on my father's lap in front of a moviola. So editing for me is something that drives me crazy, because every time I see a movie, I just think with an editor's mind, and it, you know, very few people edited like my father, and it drives me crazy.
He loved the editing, though, didn't he?
Oh, he loved, oh, yeah. Passion. I mean, Maviola was his passion.
With cigars going all the time.
Lots of cigars.
Questions from the audience? In the middle there. And then give the mic right back, and we'll spot somebody else.
What was the process of creating the adaptation? I know that he took lines from various Shakespeare plays. How much of it do you know now, or were you, not conscious so much then, or were you?
No, I wasn't then, but you know, he really started this he started it in high school, you know, at Todd School for Boys. He started writing this then. And then it sort of became The Five Kings, which he did in, I believe,
39.
Yeah. I have a script that says 37.
Oh, well.
Uh-huh.
You didn't bring that?
No, sorry. Only one.
Because they could do a comparison.
But no, he did, like many projects, I mean, he started something and really never gave up. And that is something I think that people should know, that he was, you know, he really did continue no matter what happened. And it was a passion of his. It was an absolute passion. And to be able to put 5 Shakespearean plays together and make it understandable, you were laughing, you were understand. Well, finally, we were also being able to hear it for the first time ever, thanks to Criterion. But it's a pretty extraordinary thing, you know. And pretty ballsy, too, I think, don't you?
Everything he did was ballsy.
Pretty ballsy, yeah. Yes. There was this
question?
Gentleman right here.
Over here.
I can speak loud, I think.
Well, we need to, this is for posterity.
For people, yeah, so it's for people in the back are probably here too.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us why it has been so hard to see this film.
Well, what happened to it is that the Spaniards, really was Emiliano Piedra, had it for, it really wasn't his business. Movies were not his business. He was involved in some electric company or something, quite a rich man. And it's really, it's the only movie he really ever made. His wife was an actress. And they really, in the end, didn't care about it. You know, it ended up being, as I'm sure lots of you know, being bootlegged all over the place. And I tried desperately with Julian Schlossberg, if anybody's familiar with him, he did Othello with me. And we desperately tried to convince then the widow and daughter of Emiliano Piedra to do what we had done with Othello. We actually even brought them to Cannes, and Cannes was an extraordinary experience. I mean, we had something like an 8-minute standing ovation, which is something I'll never forget. It was unbelievable. We thought that by bringing them to Cannes, they would sort of like go, oh, wow, maybe this will happen with Chimes. But they just wouldn't budge. And what they wouldn't do is they would not put a stop to the bootleg. So, most people would say, well, I'm not going to invest any money in a movie that is being shown all over the world in different ways. And I have heard that Peter Becker's father,
Bill Becker.
Yeah, I didn't know his name. Thank you.
Yeah, Bill Becker passed away.
Thank you. His had wanted to restore Chimes for over 16 years, which is...
We've been wanting to show it for 30 years.
And we did.
Well, we showed it last year with special permission from the Filmoteca.
Right.
Two screenings, once on Super Bowl Sunday, packed. I love that.
I know you do. No, we didn't know that.
The last time in New York, the last time it was announced at the Public Theater in the late 70s, I believe.
Right.
And they had to pull it at the last minute.
Oh,
and
really?
It was a big article in the New York Times.
Wow.
So it's really been rare.
Yeah, it is. It's a rare. And this is something that he just so wanted. I'm sure you all know that this is the movie he wanted to be remembered by. So this is why it is just so wonderful that this movie is being shown and in its full glory. It's, as I said, my heart is just overwhelmed.
Over here. Where's the mic? Got to keep him on his toes here.
I'm glad he's doing it.
I have a really brief question.
Yes.
But is or will the script be published for the public?
This my script?
Well, yeah, the only copy of it, I don't know.
Well, it's not mine. I mean, I don't own it, so that's something I really think you have to ask.
Facsimile script.
And I need to say something about this script. This was the first script I got, and after that I was just handed pages, which is what he did. He did very few annotations in his scripts. He would just, decide to change something and go and type it the next night or that night and then have it for the next day. But my part was actually big. Ah, thank God. It isn't. But it was actually much bigger than what you see on screen. But I got rheumatic fever 4 months into the shooting. So there's a lot of me in here that isn't me. There was this double. It was a little French boy that apparently everybody hated with a passion. He was a terribly bad-tempered little monster. And
But there's a lot of doubles in this movie.
John Gielgud. So many.
A lot of the long shots of Gielgud are not Gielgud.
Well, Keith, we just found out. Yes.
Yep, we found out the other day. Keith told us that the legs writhing in the mud, that's his legs. And it was done inside in a kitchen.
That's right. Yes.
Sorry to spoil it for you.
No, but there's so many people in this movie that were actually doing other things. I mean, there is Edmond Richard, who was the photographer, and he plays, you know, this, because he had a very interesting face. My father was always fascinated by somebody who had an interesting face, so he would use it in a movie. There's three waiters in this movie that I remember because we were having lunch somewhere or dinner, and he would go, oh, he's just got to be in this movie because he's got such an interesting face. And it's true.
That wasn't a way to not pay the bill or anything.
That might be as well. But
your father also doubled a lot of voices in the movie, which he did in a lot of his movies, like The Trial. He does at least 20 voices.
Well, that again is lack of money.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but he liked it. Come on.
He was
a radio actor.
Of course.
But he did the voice of the sheriff at the end on the horse, the bald sheriff. That's a lot of you might have noticed that was Wells.
But it was very funny. It was really for me to see all these people who were behind the camera suddenly all dressed up in period. I don't know. I was cracking up. It was just making it's funny to see. It was wonderful to see.
Oh, this is easy, Kyle, in the front. Okay. Get front and then there. Okay.
I just was curious because I, as you were talking about Keith Baxter the other night, had some vivid memories of the production. And I was wondering, even though you were so young, if there was anything you remember about maybe a certain cast member or some story that you carry with you.
I have one story, and I have one story about Keith. And I know he'll be not very happy to know that I'm telling this story, but I'm going to tell it. In the scene where they decide to rob I don't know who they're robbing. I can't remember. Who is it?
Yeah.
The Pilgrims. That's right. Yeah. And Keith, there's that scene where he has the cape and he goes like this and he's got a hat on. He shot it 11 times. He could not keep that hat on. Every time the cape, it would just go whoosh, off it went. And my father wanted to keep the shot because it was very funny. And Keith absolutely insisted that he was going to keep this hat on. And he finally did it on the 11th take.
Your father didn't do many comic parts, actually, in movies. But
no.
he was very funny.
Yes, he was very funny in it.
Because he did radio comedy. That's fantastic.
Yeah, but it's very interesting because he thought that his acting was not very good in this movie. And I think it's probably one of the best acting in his career, don't you?
Yeah. But he was very intimidated by Gielgud.
Well, he was brilliant. Wasn't Sir John absolutely incredible in it?
It seemed like your father was lavishing more care on Gielgud scenes. That's my opinion. I don't know if you agree.
They were also in that amazing, you know, cathedral. They were in the cathedral.
But the lighting on Gielgud seems to be special.
Yes. Yeah, well,
that's the way I see
it.
Anyway.
Yes. It's Sir John.
Next question.
Yeah, I just wanted to know about the casting and if you had a relationship with John Gielgud before, if you know anything about the casting process, because it's interesting to see him on screen as opposed to Gielgud in there. I mean, they're very different characters, but the way they approach the role is interesting. And
right.
Yeah, Gielgud was incredible.
Yeah, he was. He really was. Well, both Sir Ralph Richardson and Sir John were friends of my father. I mean, we lived in England for, again, a split second when I was about on and off. I mean, we actually had homes in England for a while.
Really? You had homes everywhere. Yeah.
Well, not really. There was a lot of hotels.
Yeah.
There was a lot of hotels. But they were both friends of my father, and he greatly admired Sir Ralph. And we went to see a play in London, in the West End, and I wish I remembered the name of it, but they were both starring in it, and it was just the two of them. And I think from that play is when he decided that he wanted both of them, and he wasn't really sure which one, if Sir John was going to do the narration or, you know, and Sir Ralph was going to play the king. So it was kind of like a, you know, let's toss the coin and see.
It was the right choice.
Yeah, it was. He was so good in it. I mean, that's an Oscar-winning performance, I think.
If Bosley Crowther hadn't trashed it.
Yes, I know. That really destroyed this movie. Do you all know this?
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
You do know this?
Yeah.
Would you like to? I think you probably
got a scathing review by the worst critic in history, Bosley Crowther, and it destroyed its prospects for the whole country.
Yep.
Even though it got raves in many other quarters.
Yeah, absolutely. In Europe, it was.
Yeah.
He won two awards, I think it was, in Cannes.
Right.
Bosley Crowther just absolutely trashed the movie, him and everything else. And not only did it destroy the movie and it never got seen in this country, it destroyed my father. I mean, because, you know, critics were, if some critics said something bad, he really took it seriously. I mean, it was, we don't tiptoe around him.
Crowther also panned Citizen Kane, I might add. So.
Yeah, well, shall we just not talk about this man?
We shouldn't even say the name. Next question, please.
Right in the middle.
Oh.
Me?
Just.
It struck me, Beatrice, from time to time in this film, it really struck me how I thought that there were moments when your father's face looked more like he really looked in real life, outside of the film, than probably any other film that I've seen of his, that I could really see him, his expression, just moments, I mean, really like microseconds, where I thought he really looked more like he looked outside of films when he was just in his real life. What do you think?
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot of him in Falstaff, or there was a lot of Falstaff in him, and I think that's a very good thing to notice, and I don't know if the rest of the audience agrees. I think he was very much him. Well, people have talked about that, the king and Falstaff was his father, and no. If there's any relationship at all in that, and I'm not sure there is, but it would be his guardian, Dada Bernstein, and Roger Hill, Skipper, who was the principal, right, of headmaster, I'm sorry, of Todd's school. Those were the two very important men in his life, and they did, you know, vie for his love and attention in real life. So if there's any comparison there, I think those would be the two men, certainly not his father.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of that. How's the script doing, by the way? It's only in the
third row. Yeah. We've got to be really amusing here.
We're sitting around time.
Let's take some questions from the back, because they have the script up front.
And they are, yes.
Yeah. We only have one person doing this?
Yes,
one more question? One more
question.
It's
got to be in the back.
Somebody in the middle, too.
Was it as cold as it looked?
Freezing. Absolutely freezing. I have never been so cold. In fact, we never shot in continuity. I think the second scene I ever did was when Falstaff is dead and he's lying in the coffin. And it was so cold. I remember they put a pillow underneath because I was sitting on concrete. And I was starting to get sick then, right before rheumatic fever. And, and it took a while for everybody to figure out that that's what I had. But I sat on this pillow, and I had my little speech, which actually was taken out because Bardolph now says my words. And I don't know why that happened. But I actually did it in one take, and it was great. And everybody was like, oh, wow, that was fabulous. And then, of course, they realized that I had this big cushiony pillow underneath me, and they had to take it off, and I think I did 23 takes or something. Yeah. So maybe that's why I ended up on the editing floor.
Are there outtakes from this?
No, not that I know
Nothing.
Of.
It's,
gosh, I wish there were.
It's too bad.
I know where they would be, and they were destroyed when in our house in Spain when we had a slight
big
disaster.
Fire, yeah.
No, not the fire. No. Our house in Spain, I don't know if you all know, Robert Shaw rented it for a while, and it caught fire, and I don't know what happened. He had candles on or something like that. And what burned down was my father's study, and in it were scripts and stuff that he was working on, because we rented it really furnished with basically all our stuff in it. But what happened was that we had the Cuban ambassador who rented our house. And these people did not pay rent for I don't know how long. And then finally, when we could do something legally to get them out of there, they had destroyed the house. They ripped wallpaper off the walls. They took every possible thing they could take. They got into the basement, it was a very big house, not by today's standards, but then it was. And in the basement, my father was his editing room, and they just took everything. They destroyed everything. They pulled sinks out of the wall. We have no idea why. And that was the Cuban ambassador. maybe we shouldn't be.
This
talking
is not a commentary on some. This is not a commentary on some of the Republican candidates. When's the last time you saw your father?
Oh, when I saw him, it was probably 6 months before he died. But I actually talked to him on the phone the day he died.
Really?
Yeah.
He had done the Merv Griffin show that day.
He actually called me before he was doing the Merv show, and it was very touching because he said to me, he said, "Oh, I wish you were," because I used to go to a lot of the shows with him and sit in the audience, and he said, "Oh, I wish you were with coming." He said, I do so much better when you're out there, which was a very touching thing to say.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think this is...
Thank you. Thank you for coming to this.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.